Hello and welcome to another podcast brought to you by AIRS LA, the audio internet reading service of Los Angeles. I need to remind you, you're listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Items read on AIRS LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. My name is Nancy Porter, and it is my pleasure to share Time Magazine with you. I'm selecting articles this time to finish up the June 29th issue of Time. And there is a big focus of many articles on the ocean. It's not just a place we can go and get our toes wet in the cold water and walk on the sand. The oceans are a big part of our world. So let's see what the current issue is going on with oceans. Headline, Valuing Our Oceans. It's time for a shift in economics. This was written by Justin Warland. Troves of in-demand critical minerals sit untouched deep at the bottom of the ocean. Nickel, cobalt, and copper, to name a few. With the stroke of a pen in April, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to catalyze a gold rush in pursuit of those deposits. The value of those minerals could total in the trillions, and the Trump administration wants American companies to access them in a bid to bolster the economy. Pushback to the move has largely focused on the potential for ecological damage and the order's flouting of international rules. There is also a good case to be made that the economic and financial math may not add up. For one, the outlook of different critical minerals is evolving. Cobalt demand projections, for example, have fallen below expectations as new battery chemistries emerge that rely less on cobalt. And then there are the costs associated with missed opportunities and unknown side effects. The depths of the ocean where deep sea mining would take place have been undisturbed for millennia. In those waters, flora and fauna that could unlock medical breakthroughs sit untouched, and ocean dynamics mediate global climate conditions. If we start mucking around with our seabed floor in pursuit of short-term wealth and growth, says Hawaii Governor Josh Green, a vocal opponent of seabed mining, God knows what the long-term damage will end up being. The bigger problem is that human society, policymakers, companies, and financial institutions simply hasn't figured out how to value all that the oceans do for us. To grapple with a full assessment of the economic value of oceans would mean a wholesale rethinking of how we interact with the world deep in the seven seas. Using economics to value nature is not a new idea. For decades, scientists and economists have crunched the numbers on the contribution of what is known as ecosystem services. Those services include everything from coastal protection provided by coral reefs to the value of fisheries to local communities that rely on them for sustenance. Listing the services is one thing, tallying their worth is another challenging task. Researchers say that the total economic value of oceans needs to include the direct use of oceans like fishing and tourism, as well as indirect functions like storing carbon and protecting biodiversity that keeps the planet in balance. The math isn't simple. How can you put a price on, say, the role that oceans play regulating the global climate? Nonetheless, researchers consistently come up with figures that reach into the tens of trillions of dollars in annual value. Whatever the precise number, a bigger problem is that leaders in government and business aren't using it. A wide array of methods and techniques for ecosystem evaluation exist, but are only occasionally implemented in policy decisions, reads a 2019 paper from the European Marine Board, an ocean policy think tank. No country has fully accounted for the economic value of oceans in its policymaking. A survey of leaders in developing countries found that even though many of those nations depend on marine resources, protecting marine life ranked last among the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. To account for the value of oceans in decision-making, researchers are pushing for countries to adopt what has become known as natural capital accounting. That would entail incorporating data on the ecological and economic value of oceans into the country-level accounting systems. Such recommendations are not the work of radical activists or fringe academics. The World Bank, for example, advises that low-income countries use natural capital accounting to assess and protect their natural resources. In the absence of such a formal move, leaders concerned about economic stability would be wise to shift their thinking. In some cases, that may mean moving away from viewing the oceans as a source of easily exploited resources. In others, it may mean moving from viewing ocean conservation as an altruistic act to an act of economic self-preservation. Next article in the oceans section, headline, Questions and Answers with Sylvia Earle, the ocean conservationist on hope and why she keeps on diving. This was written by Simone Shah. Marine biologist Sylvia Earle could easily rest on her laurels. In a career that began in the 1950s, she has become a pioneer in ocean exploration and conservation. She holds the record for the deepest walk under the sea and was the first female chief scientist at the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. But on the cusp of her 90th birthday this August, she has no plans to slow down and believes that the problems currently facing our oceans have never been more urgent. Her most recent venture, Mission Blue, aims to create a worldwide network of marine protected areas known as Hope Spots. This now includes the Chesapeake Bay. Time magazine spoke to Earle in May after a dive she made in the United States' largest estuary. Question. What do you feel is the most pressing issue facing our oceans now? Answer. Ignorance, complacency, lack of awareness, that the ocean is essential to everyone, everywhere, all the time. Every breath we take, every drop of water we drink, we are connected to the ocean. It just seems perverse that we take so much for granted and are so casual about consuming nature when you realize how long it has taken for the natural systems to come to a state where we actually cannot just survive here, but thrive here. We know what to do. We just need, in this really critical crossroads in time, to use the knowledge we have and to come together. Everybody is, without exception, vulnerable to the state of the planet, the habitability of Earth. If you don't have water, if you don't have food, all of the basics anchor back to the idea that we've got to take care of what keeps Earth, our home, safe in a universe that is really inhospitable. For those who want to go to Mars and set up housekeeping, I say good luck. But it's not an alternative to Earth. We are of the Earth. Actually, we are of the ocean, because it's the ocean that makes our existence possible. As someone who has led more than 100 expeditions and logged more than 7,000 hours underwater, what's one thing you wished more people knew about our oceans? Answer: I wish people understand that the ocean is not just a massive amount of salt water, but rather it's a living system. What we put into the ocean changes the chemistry of not just the ocean, but of the planetary functions as a whole. The consequences to planetary chemistry, to planetary security, are right now facing us with the prospect of the sharp changes that we won't be able to control if they get to that tipping point. The good news through all of this, I think, is that the world has not tipped yet into a state from which we cannot recover. But we've got all the warning signs: the rapid increase in temperature, the rapid increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the rapid loss of forests on the land, and the consequences of clear-cutting forests, disrupting the carbon cycle, clear-cutting the ocean of fish, of squid, of krill from Antarctica, all of this. We know what we need to do. Question: A big part of Mission Blue's work is identifying hope spots in the ocean. When much of our ecosystems are under threat, why is it important to you to highlight these areas? Answer: The real purpose underlying the hope spot concept is to ignite public awareness and support for protecting nature. The hope spot is a means to a broader end, to get people to be aware of why the ocean in particular matters. Land and sea together, the whole world is one big, mostly blue hope spot. But we want to energize individual champions, communities, institutions to come together with a common purpose of protecting a place that they know and love. This is meant to highlight and enforce and support everybody else who is trying to do something to turn from decline to recovery. One hope spot, one community, one champion at a time. Question: You have been involved in ocean conservation for decades. What changes have you noticed since you first started this work? Well, we've learned more about the nature of the ocean, the nature of the planet as a whole, and even about ourselves. When I was a child, no one had been to the moon. No one had been to the deepest part of the sea. The internet did not exist. Think about the things we did not know, even about the microbial world and how influential that is on everything and everyone. That was just missing in our understanding of how the world functions. We've learned more about the magnitude of our climate and what our role has been in bringing about change. In many cases, we've lost more than during all preceding history. So, question: You are almost 90 years old. What keeps you diving? Answer: Why not? I think it's important to keep doing the things you love for as long as you can. How can I resist when most of the areas on Earth where life exists have yet to be explored? I want to keep doing it as long as I can breathe. Don't you want to do the same thing? Okay, the next article about the oceans is titled "Coral Reefs in Peril: How We Can Protect the Ocean Right Now." This was written by Mark Benioff and Ed Russo. Benioff is Salesforce chair and CEO, a Time magazine owner, and a global environmental and philanthropic leader. And Ed Russo is chair of the White House Environmental Advisory Task Force, president of the Florida Keys Environmental Coalition, and a board member of Reef Relief. He is a longtime environmental advisor to President Trump. The ocean may be nature's single greatest gift to humanity. It provides about half of the oxygen we breathe, feeds billions of people, supports countless jobs in every corner of the globe, and absorbs more carbon dioxide than anything else on Earth. The ocean connects us all. But right now, the ocean is sounding an unmistakable alarm. Fishing boats around the world are returning emptier. Coastal zones are growing warmer and murkier, and they are becoming more polluted as millions of gallons of water laced with pharmaceuticals, forever chemicals, and sewage leak into the sea. Coral reefs are turning white. We come to these challenges with different experiences and perspectives. One of us lives in the Florida Keys and chairs the White House Environmental Advisory Task Force. The other one of us lives in Hawaii and the Bay Area and leads a global technology company. At the same time, we share something fundamental: a deep commitment to the health of the oceans and a deep belief that differences in some areas should not prevent us from working together on pressing issues where we agree. We need to roll up our sleeves and get to work. We have an opportunity for global action. Officials from more than 100 nations, scientists, and innovators recently gathered in Nice, France, for the United Nations Ocean Conference, held only once every few years. The meeting tested our ability to work together across sectors, borders, and worldviews, and to act on behalf of future generations. That's why we're calling for a focused global effort to restore coral reef health. Coral reef ecosystems, from the famous reefs of the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary to the Great Barrier in Australia, are the ocean's rainforests. Vital and vulnerable, they shelter nearly a quarter of marine life, buffer coastal communities from storms, and sustain billions of dollars in fisheries and tourism. Yet, they are disappearing at unprecedented speed. Rising temperatures are part of the problem, but so are decades of negligence, coastal pollution, overfishing, and damage from dredging and poorly planned ports and coastal infrastructure. We believe that addressing coral reef health is a smart place to focus, not because it's the only crisis, but because it offers a clear, actionable, achievable goal that can unite governments and ocean advocates across sectors. We also know that nature-based solutions are powerful, proven, and cost-effective tools for addressing the impacts of climate change and biodiversity loss. Restoring coral reefs, like planting and conserving trees, empowers nature to do what it does best: regenerate, protect, and sustain life. We've seen a model for this kind of collaboration before. As part of the Trillion Trees movement, the first Trump administration joined an unprecedented global effort to reforest the planet. Trees are the planet's natural air purifiers, the single most effective device we have to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. There remains far more work to do. Yet, with more than 9.7 billion trees pledged and more than 54 million hectares of land under sustainable management so far, the Trillion Trees Initiative demonstrates the progress that's possible when we align behind a common goal. We believe that we can take lessons from the Trillion Trees movement underwater. It's helpful to think of the ocean as a patient in the emergency room. Long-term recovery depends on curing the disease And yes, different people may have different ideas on the best long-term approach. But right now, we're losing a lot of blood and we need to stop it fast. We need to deal with immediate problems that threaten the health of coral reefs. Solutions exist, and many communities, ecopreneurs, and conservationists are already deploying them. Here's what a focused global effort to restore coral reefs could look like. 1. Curb septic and sewage runoff, especially in critical reef zones like Hawaii, South Florida, Puerto Rico, American Samoa, and Guam. By upgrading and modernizing the infrastructure that treats wastewater and scaling new technologies such as gentrification that converts toxic nitrogen to a harmless gas. We also need to set up water testing programs that help us pinpoint and address pollution hotspots near the important reefs. Nothing we do to restore coral reefs will matter if water quality doesn't improve to the point where they can survive. 2, scale science-based coral restoration, including advanced farming of specially grown corals and responsible management of protected marine zones. 3, stop plastic, which harms reefs by smothering coral, increasing the risk of disease, and entangling marine life before it reaches the ocean. We can tackle this through bans on single-use waste, incentives for alternative materials, and, as a last resort, the implementation of new technologies that intercept ocean-bound plastic in our waterways. The world needs more efforts like Hawaii's Papahanaumokuʻea Marine Debris Project, which is removing plastics from the ocean, and the Benioff Ocean Science Lab, which helps innovate solutions to capture and remove plastic from rivers before it ends up in the ocean. 4, empower fishing businesses to promote sustainable practices by eliminating overfishing, ending harmful fisheries subsidies globally, and reducing the sometimes destructive impacts of fisheries on marine habitats. And finally, 5, restore coastlines with mangroves, wetlands, seagrass meadows, and coastal forests. Many of these ecosystems can serve as nursery habitat for commercially and ecologically important coral reef fish. They also often act together to dissipate waves that pound coastlines and serve as natural, free, and self-repairing seawalls. Healthy shorelines mean healthier oceans, and healthier oceans in turn mean safer and more prosperous coastal communities. We recognize that some will say calling attention to discrete natural-based approaches like coral reef restoration is a moral hazard, distracting from the bigger long-term solutions to our environmental challenges. At the same time, there is widespread agreement that the crisis facing the oceans demands a diverse range of approaches. We need to harness every available solution. Sometimes we need to start with the work and the opportunity for collaboration right in front of us. That's what made the conference in Nice so important. It came as ocean action has never been more essential. It required leadership from every sector, including business, government, and science. The question is whether we can turn shared understanding into shared action. What's needed is the will to save the ocean, one commitment at a time. All right, and we will finish with An article from the world of technology. Titled, "The Orb Will See You Now." An audacious startup wants to prove that you're human. What else does it want? This was written by Billy Parigio in San Francisco and Seoul. And this story was supported by Turbo Grants. And it also includes reporting by Stephen Kim in Seoul. Once again, Sam Altman wants to show you the future. The CEO of OpenAI is standing on a sparse stage in San Francisco, preparing to reveal his next move to an attentive crowd. "We needed some way for identifying, authenticating humans in the age of AGI," Altman explains, referring to artificial general intelligence. "We wanted a way to make sure that humans stayed special and central." The solution Altman came up with is looming behind him. It's a white sphere about the size of a beach ball with a camera at its center. The company that makes it, known as Tools for Humanity, calls this mysterious device the Orb. Stare into the heart of the plastic and silicone orb globe, and it will map the unique furrows and ciliary zones of your iris. Seconds later, you'll receive inviolative proof of your humanity, a 12,800-digit binary number known as an iris code, sent to an app on your phone. At the same time, a packet of cryptocurrency called WorldCoin, worth approximately $42, will be transferred to your digital wallet, your reward for becoming a verified human. Altman co-founded Tools for Humanity in 2019 as part of a suite of companies he believed would reshape the world. Once the tech he was developing at OpenAI passed a certain level of intelligence, he reasoned, it would mark the end of one era on the internet and the beginning of another, in which AI became so advanced, so human-like, that you would no longer be able to tell whether what you read, see, or hear online has come from a real person. When that happened, Altman imagined, we would need a new kind of online infrastructure. A human verification layer for the internet to distinguish real people from the proliferating number of bots and AI agents. And so Tools for Humanity set out to build a global proof of humanity network. It aims to verify 50 million people by the end of 2025. Ultimately, its goal is to sign up every single human being on the planet. The free crypto serves as both an incentive for users to sign up and also an entry point into what the company hopes will become the world's largest financial network, through which it believes double-digit percentages of the global economy will eventually flow. Even for Altman, these missions are audacious. If this really works, it's like a fundamental piece of infrastructure for the world, Altman tells Time magazine in a video interview from the passenger seat of a car a few days before his April 30th keynote address. The project's goal is to solve a problem partly of Altman's own making. In the near future, he and other tech leaders say, advanced AIs will be imbued with agency. In other words, the ability to not just respond to human prompting, but also to take actions independently in the world. This will enable the creation of AI coworkers that can drop into your company and begin solving problems. AI tutors that can adapt their teaching style to students' preferences. Even AI doctors that can diagnose routine cases and handle scheduling or logistics. The arrival of these virtual agents, their venture capitalist backers predict, will turbocharge our productivity and unleash an age of a material abundance. But AI agents will also have cascading consequences for the human experience online. As AI systems becomes harder to distinguish from people, websites may face difficult trade-offs, says a recent paper by researchers from 25 different universities, nonprofits, and tech companies, including OpenAI. There is a significant risk that digital institutions will be unprepared for a time when AI-powered agents, including those leveraged by malicious actors, overwhelm other activity online. On social media platforms like X and Facebook, bot-driven accounts are amassing billions of views on AI-generated content. In April, the foundation that runs Wikipedia disclosed that AI bots scraping the site were making the encyclopedia too costly to sustainably run. Later the same month, researchers from the University of Zurich found that AI-generated comments on the subreddit r/changemyview were up to 6 times as successful as human-written ones at persuading unknowing users to change their minds. The arrival of agents won't only threaten our ability to distinguish between authentic and AI content online. It will also challenge the internet's core business model, online advertising, which relies on the assumption that ads are being viewed by humans. The internet will change very drastically sometime in the next 12 to 24 months, says Tools for Humanity CEO Alex Blania. So we have to succeed, or I'm not sure what else would happen. For 4 years, Blania's team has been testing the Orb's hardware abroad. Now the U.S. rollout has arrived. Over the next 12 months, 7,500 orbs will be arriving in dozens of American cities, in locations like gas stations, Bode Gas, and flagship stores in Los Angeles, Austin, Texas, and Miami, Florida. The project's founders and fans hope the orb's United States debut will kickstart a new phase of growth. The San Francisco keynote address was titled, At Last. It's not clear the public appetite matches the exultant branding. Tools for Humanity has verified just 12 million humans since mid-2023, a pace Blania concedes is well behind schedule. Few online platforms currently support the so-called world ID that the orb bestows upon its visitors, leaving little to entice users to give up their biometrics beyond the lure of free crypto. Even Altman isn't sure whether the whole thing can work. I can see how this becomes a fairly mainstream thing in a few years, he says, or I can see that it's still only used by a small subset of people who think about the world in a certain way. Yet, as the internet becomes overrun with AI, the creators of this strange new piece of hardware are betting that everybody in the world will soon want, or need, to visit an orb. The biometric code it creates, they predict, will become a new type of digital passport, without which you might be denied passage to the internet of the future, from dating apps to government services. In a best-case scenario, World ID could be a privacy-preserving way to fortify the internet against an AI-driven deluge of fake or deceptive content. It could also enable the distribution of universal basic income, a policy that Altman has previously touted as AI automation transforms the global economy. To examine what this new technology might mean, I reported from 3 continents, interviewed 10 Tools for Humanity executives and investors, reviewed hundreds of pages of company documents, and even verified my own humanity. The internet will inevitably need some kind of proof of humanity system in the near future, says Divya Siddharth, founder of the nonprofit Collective Intelligence Project. The real question, she argues, is whether such a system will be centralized, a big security nightmare that enables a lot of surveillance, or privacy-preserving, as the orb claims to be. Questions remain about Tools for Humanity's corporate structure, its yoking to an unstable cryptocurrency, and what power it would concentrate in the hands of its owners if successful. Yet, it's also one of the only attempts to solve what many see as an increasingly urgent problem. There are some issues with it, Siddharth says, of World ID, but you can't preserve the internet in amber. Something in this direction is necessary. In March, I met Blania at Tools for Humanity's San Francisco headquarters, where a large screen displays the number of weekly orb verifications by country. A few days earlier, the CEO had attended a $1 million per head dinner at Mar-a-Lago with President Donald Trump, whom he credits with clearing the way for the company's U.S. launch by relaxing crypto regulations. Given Sam is a very high-profile target, Blania says, we just decided that we would let the other companies fight that fight and enter the U.S. once the air is clear. As a kid growing up in Germany, Blania was a little different from his peers. Other kids were like drinking a lot or doing a lot of parties, and I was just building a lot of things that could potentially blow up, he recalls. At the California Institute of Technology, where he was pursuing research for a master's degree, he spent many evenings reading the blogs of startup gurus like Paul Graham and Altman. Then in 2019, Blania received an email from Max Novenstern, an entrepreneur who had been kicking around a concept with Altman to build a global cryptocurrency network. They were looking for technical minds to help with the project. Over cappuccinos, Altman told Blania he was certain about three things. First, smarter than human AI was not only possible, but inevitable. And it would soon mean you could no longer assume that anything you read, saw, or heard on the internet was human created. Second, cryptocurrency and other decentralized technologies would be a massive force for change in the world. And third, scale was essential to any crypto network's value. The goal of WorldCoin, as the project was initially called, was to combine those three insights. Altman took a lesson from PayPal, the company co-founded by his mentor, Peter Thiel. Of its initial funding, PayPal spent less than $10 million, additional $70 million or so, into a referral program whereby new users and the person who invited them would each receive $10 in credit. The referral program helped make PayPal a leading payment platform. Altman thought a version of that strategy would propel WorldCoin to similar heights. He wanted to create a new cryptocurrency and give it to users as a reward for signing up. The more people who joined the system, the higher the token's value would theoretically rise. Since 2019, the project has raised $244 million from investors like Coinbase and the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz. That money paid for the $50 million cost of designing the orb, plus maintaining the software it runs on. The total market of all WorldCoins in existence, however, is far higher, around $12 billion. That number is a bit misleading. Most of those coins are not in circulation, and WorldCoin's price has fluctuated wildly. Still, It allows the company to reward users for signing up at no cost to itself. The main lure for investors is the crypto upside. Some 75% of all world coins are set aside for humans to claim when they sign up, or as referral bonuses. The remaining 25 are split between Tools for Humanity's backers and staff, including Blania and Altman. "I'm really excited to make a lot of money," Blania says. From the beginning, Altman was thinking about the consequences of the AI revolution he intended to unleash. On May 21st, he announced plans to team up with famed former Apple designer Joni Ive on a new AI personal device. A future in which advanced AI could perform most tasks more effectively than humans would bring a wave of unemployment and economic dislocation, he reasoned. Some kind of wealth redistribution might be necessary. In 2016, he partially funded a study of basic income, which gave $1,000 per month to low-income individuals in Illinois and Texas. But there was no single financial system that would allow money to be sent to everybody in the world. Nor was there a way to stop an individual human from claiming their share twice, or to identify a sophisticated AI pretending to be human and pocketing some cash of its own. In 2023, Tools for Humanity raised the possibility of using the network to redistribute the profits of AI labs that were able to automate human behavior. "As AI advances," it said, "fairly distributing access and some of the created value through UBI will play an increasingly vital role in counteracting the concentration of economic power." Blania was taken by the pitch and agreed to join the project as a co-founder. "Most people told us we were very stupid or crazy or insane, including Silicon Valley investors," Blania says. At least until ChatGPT came out in 2022, transforming OpenAI into one of the world's most famous tech companies and kickstarting a market bull run. "Things suddenly started to make more and more sense to the external world," Blania says, of the vision to develop a global proof of humanity network. "You have to imagine a world in which you will have very smart and competent systems somehow flying through the internet with different goals and ideas of what they want to do, and us having no idea anymore of what we're dealing with." After our interview, Blania's head of communication ushers me over to a circular wooden structure where eight orbs face one another. The scene feels like a cross between an Apple store and a ceremonial altar. "Do you want to get verified?" she asks. Putting aside my reservations for the purposes of research, I flash a QR code at the orb, then look into it. A minute or so later, my phone buzzes with confirmation. "I have been issued my own personal world ID and some world coin." While I stared into the orb, several complex procedures had taken place at once. A neural network took inputs from multiple sensors, an infrared camera, a thermometer to confirm I was a living human. Simultaneously, a telephoto lens zoomed in on my iris, capturing the physical traits within that distinguish me from every other human on Earth. It then converted that image into an iris code, a numerical abstraction of my unique biometric data. Then the orb checked to see if my iris code matched any it had seen before, using a technique allowing encrypted data to be compared without revealing the underlying information. Before the orb deleted my data, it turned my iris code into several derivative codes, none of which on its own can be linked back to the original, encrypted them, deleted the only copies of the decryption keys, and sent each one to a different secure servant, so that future users' iris codes can be checked for uniqueness against mine. If I were to use my world ID to access a website, that site would learn nothing about me except that I'm a human. The orb is open source, so outside experts can examine its code and verify the company's privacy claims. I did a colonoscopy on this company and these technologies before I agreed to join, says Tremor Trania, a Trump donor and former U.S. ambassador to Austria, who now serves as Tools for Humanity's chief business officer. It's the most privacy-preserving technology on the planet, he says. Only weeks later, when researching what would happen if I wanted to delete my data, do I discover that Tools for Humanity's privacy claims rest on what feels like a sleight of hand. The company argues that in modifying your iris code, it has effectively anonymized your biometric data. If you ask Tools for Humanity to delete your iris codes, it will delete the ones stored on your phone, but not the derivatives. Those, it argues, are no longer your personal data at all. But if I were to return to an orb after deleting my data, it would still recognize those codes as uniquely mine. Once you look into the orb, a piece of your identity remains in the system forever. If users could truly delete that data, the premise of one ID per human would collapse. Tools for Humanity's chief privacy officer, Damian Kieran, tells me when I call seeking an explanation. People could delete and sign up for new world IDs after being suspended from a platform, or claim their WorldCoin tokens, sell them, delete their data, and cash in again. This argument fell flat with EU regulators in Germany, who recently declared that the orb posed fundamental data protection issues and ordered the company to allow European users to fully delete even their anonymized data. Tools for Humanity has appealed. The regulator is now reassessing the decision. Just like any other technology service, users cannot delete data that is not personal data, Kieran said in a statement. If a person could delete anonymized data that can't be linked to them by Word or any third party, it would allow bad actors to circumvent the security and safety that World ID is trying to bring to every human. On a balmy afternoon this spring, I climbed a flight of stairs up to a room above a restaurant in an outer suburb of Seoul. Five elderly South Koreans tap on their phones as they wait to be verified by the two orbs in the center of the room. We don't really know how to distinguish between AI and humans anymore, an attendant in a company t-shirt explains in Korean, gesturing toward the spheres. We need a way to verify that we're human and not artificial intelligence. So how do we do that? Well, humans have eyes, but AI doesn't. The attendant ushers an elderly woman over to an orb. It bleeps. Open your eyes, a disembodied voice says in English. The woman stares to the camera. Seconds later, she checks her phone and sees that a packet of WorldCoin worth 75,000 Korean won, about $54, has landed in her digital wallet. Congratulations, the app tells her. You are now a verified human. A couple dozen orbs have been available in South Korea since 2023, verifying roughly 55,000 people. Now, Tools for Humanity is redoubling its efforts there. At an event in a traditional wooden hammock house in central Seoul, an executive announces that 250 orbs will soon be dispersed around the country, with the aim of verifying 1 million Koreans in the next 12 months. South Korea has high levels of smartphone usage, crypto and AI adoption, and internet access, while average wages are modest enough for the free WorldCoin on offer to still be an enticing draw, all of which makes it fertile testing ground for the company's ambitious global expansion. Yet things seem off to a slow start. Tools for Humanity had constructed a wooden structure with 8 orbs facing one another. Locals and tourists wander past looking bemused. Few volunteer themselves up. Most who do tell me they're crypto enthusiasts who came intentionally, driven more by the spirit of early adoption than the free coins. The next day, I visit a coffee shop in central Seoul where a chrome orb sits unassumingly in one corner. Wu Ryujin, a 21-year-old student from China, strikes up a conversation with the barista, who doubles as the orb's operator. Wu was invited here by a friend who said both could claim free cryptocurrency if he signed up. The barista speaks to him through the process, speeds him through the process. Wu accepts the privacy disclosure without even reading it and widens his eyes for the orb. Soon, he's verified. I wasn't told anything about the privacy policy, he says on his way out. I just came for the money. As Altman's car winds through San Francisco, I ask about the vision he laid out in 2019, that AI would make it harder for us to trust each other online. To my surprise, he rejects the framing. I'm much more about, like, what is the good we can create rather than the bad we can stop, he says. It's like, oh, we've got to avoid the bot overrun or whatever. It's just that we can do a lot of special things for humans. It's an answer that may reflect how his role has changed over the years. Altman is now the chief public cheerleader of a $300 billion company that's touting the transformative utility of AI agents. The rise of agents, he and others say, will be a boon for our quality of life, like having an assistant on hand who can answer your most pressing questions, carry out mundane tasks, and help you develop new skills. It's an optimistic vision that may well pan out, but it doesn't quite fit with the prophecies of AI-enabled infopocalypse that Tools for Humanity was founded on. Altman waves away a question about the influence he and other investors stand to gain if their vision is realized. Most holders, he assumes, will have already started selling their tokens. Too early, he adds. What I think would be bad is if an early crew had a lot of control over the protocol, he says. And that's where I think the commitment to decentralization is so cool. Altman is referring to the World Protocol, the underlying technology upon which the Orb, World Coin, and World ID all rely. Tools for Humanity is developing it, but has committed to giving control to its users over time. A process, they say, will prevent power from being concentrated in the hands of a few executives or investors. Tools for Humanity would remain a for-profit for company and could levy fees on platforms that use World ID. But other companies would be able to compete for customers by building alternative apps or even alternative orbs. The plan draws on ideas that animated the crypto ecosystems in the late 2010s and early 2020s, when evangelists for emerging blockchain technologies argued that the centralization of power, especially in large so-called Web 2.0 tech companies, was responsible for many of the problems plaguing the modern internet. Just as decentralized cryptocurrencies could reform a financial system controlled by economic elites, so too would it be possible to create decentralized organizations run by their members instead of CEOs. How such a system might work in practice remains unclear. Building a community-based governance systems, Tools for Humanity says in a 2023 white paper, represents perhaps the most formidable challenge of the entire project. Altman has a pattern of making idealistic promises that shift over time. He founded OpenAI as a nonprofit in 2015 with a mission to develop AGI safely and for the benefit of all humanity. To raise money, OpenAI restructured itself as a for-profit company in 2019, but with overall control still in the hands of its nonprofit board. Last year, Altman proposed yet another restructure, one which would dilute the board's control and allow more profits to flow to shareholders. Why, I ask, should the public trust Tool for Humanity's commitment to freely surrender influence and power? I think you will just see the continued decentralization via the protocol, he says. The value here is going to live in the network, and the network will be owned and governed by a lot of people. Altman talks less about universal basic income these days. He recently mused about an alternative, which he called universal basic computer. Instead of AI companies redistributing their profits, he seems to suggest that they could instead give everyone in the world fair access to super powerful AI. Blania tells me he recently made the decision to stop talking about UBI at Tools for Humanity. UBI is one potential answer, he says. Just giving people access to the internet AI models and having them learn faster and better is another. Says Altman, I still don't know what the right answer is. I believe we should do a better job of distribution of resources than we currently do. When I probe the question of why people should trust him, Altman gets irritated. I understand you hate AI, and that's fine, he says. If you want to frame it as the downside of AI is that there's going to be a proliferation of very convincing AI systems that are pretending to be human, and we need ways to know what is really human authorized versus not really human, then yeah, I think you'd call that a downside of AI. But it's not how I would naturally frame it. The phrase human authorized hints at a tension between World ID and OpenAI's plans for AI agents. An internet where World ID is required to access most services might impede the usefulness of the agents that OpenAI and others are developing. So Tools for Humanity is building a system that would allow users to delegate their World ID to an agent, allowing the bot to take actions online on their behalf, according to Tiago Seda, the company's chief product officer. We've built everything in a way that can be very easily delegable to an agent, Seda says. It's a measure that would allow humans to be held accountable for the actions of their AIs. But it suggests that Tools for Humanity missions may be shifting beyond simply proving humanity and toward becoming the infrastructure that enables AI agents to proliferate with human authorization. World ID does not tell you whether a piece of content is AI generated or human generated. All it tells you is whether the account that posted it is a human or a bot. Even in a world where everybody had a World ID, our online spaces might still be filled with AI-generated text, images, and videos. As I say goodbye to Altman, I'm left feeling conflicted about his project. If the internet is going to be transformed by AI agents, then some kind of proof of humanity system will almost certainly be necessary. Yet, if the orb becomes a piece of internet infrastructure, it could give Altman, a beneficiary of the proliferation of AI content, significant influence over a leading defense mechanism against it. People might have no choice but to participate in the network in order to access social media or online services. I thought of an encounter I witnessed in Seoul. In the room above the restaurant, Cho Jeong-yong, 75, watched her friend get verified by an orb. Cho had been invited to do the same, but declined. The reward wasn't enough for her to surrender part of her identity. Your iris is uniquely yours, and we don't really know how it might be used, she says. Seeing the machine made me think, are we becoming machines instead of humans now? Everything is changing, and we don't know how it will all turn out. And that concludes our reading of Time Magazine for this session. I need to remind you again, you've been listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Items read on Air Zelay are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Again, my name is Nancy Porter, and it is my pleasure to bring you excerpts from Time Magazine.